Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. In July, hundreds of employees at the Bluegrass Chemical Agent Destruction Pilot Plant are expected to begin neutralizing GB nerve agent rockets, that's sarin gas. This will be the fifth and final campaign to destroy munitions stored at the Bluegrass Army Depot in Madison County. Stu Johnson reports on day-to-day measures being taken to try to ensure that all goes well in this phase of chemical weapon elimination.
Still on the to-do list for workers at the Bluegrass Army Depot D-Mill plant are more than 50,000 nerve agent rockets. These munitions, packed in igloos at the military installation for many decades, are GB sarin rockets. Lieutenant Colonel Edward Williams is the outgoing commander of the Bluegrass Chemical Activity. BGCA is a tenant of the 15,000-acre depot and is responsible for safekeeping the chemical weapons stockpile stored there. Williams says movement of munitions to the disposal plant is based on staffing.
So if we're missing, we don't have enough personnel, we don't have the right equipment, or one of the other stakeholders involved in the munition movement, it's not, you know, don't have enough personnel and so forth, then the mission doesn't happen. So we have what you call a very exhaustive, methodical checklist that we do in order for each mission to happen every day.
Colonel Williams says the focus is on keeping the area safe and secure while protecting the workforce, community, and environment. Grass-covered mounds are found on the depot acreage. That's where nerve agent projectiles and rockets have been stored.
As those igloos are empty with rockets, then we replace them with the rocket warhead returns, which that's the rockets after they've been demated, punched, and drained, and they put in overpack containers, and that's waiting for further destruction at a later date.
Ask what will happen to the empty igloos once the drained rockets are destroyed in what's called the static detonation chamber. Williams said that's beyond the scope of the Bluegrass Chemical Activity. Steve Frank is senior system engineer at the Bluegrass Chemical Agent Destruction Pilot Plant. He says it's his job to keep the plant operational. Frank says the GB rocket's condition could be different from previous processed munitions.
They could be a little bit more degraded, and I'm not saying unstable by any means. It's just that we have to deal with certain things as the walls could be a little thinner that holds the agent cavities.
Frank says one adjustment made during the changeover was to reduce the force of robot grips on the warheads as they pass between pieces of equipment. There are instances when workers enter the area where disposal operations take place. When that's required, the number of people involved increases by 10 to 15.
They will require two people to go in at a time with two people on standby, and then we've got, you know, we have medical staff on standby. We've got control room operators watching. We have medical watching, you know, their vitals as they do it.
A significant part of safety and preparedness with an operation like this is the consideration of the worst-case scenario, and that, by most accounts, would be a release of nerve agent in any form beyond the plant walls or depot grounds. Steve Frank says the magnitude of the mission is well recognized.
Oh, yeah, that's extremely not likely at all. We take safety protocols here as the best that I've been around, and I've worked in the nuclear industry for 5 years prior to this.
Frank says he used to work on safety systems for the shutdown of nuclear power plants. He says safety runs through his blood. Another key official in this chemical weapon disposal process is Candace Coyle, who is the site project manager for the pilot plant. Coyle says there are many layers of oversight when it comes to munition destruction.
It really is an orchestration across all the organizations to make sure we have a clear command and control on a daily basis, that there's people understanding what has to happen that day and who makes the decision, because things are going to happen that we don't predict, and we have that set up where there's a person there that can say this is what the next step would be.
Bechtel Parsons Bluegrass is a systems contractor, and Ron Hink heads that program. He says crews have already worked with GB projectiles in the first of the five disposal campaigns. Hink says a lot of experience has been gained throughout previous munition destruction. With all this said, there's always the possibility of an unforeseen event, And that's the situation which consumes much of what Dustin Heiser does. Heiser is the director of the Madison County Emergency Management Agency. He says spreading information about what to do if an accident occurs is an ongoing effort.
I think it's always important to continue the education of emergency awareness, being prepared, understanding what certain siren tones or activations mean. So yeah, I believe that is something that's always needed.
Anyone new to the Madison County area can come to the Emergency Management Office on South Keeneland Drive in Richmond to pick up a shelter-in-place kit. Heiser says new in-home radios, which can receive emergency information, will be distributed. All the disposal operations, along with this particular emergency preparedness, are expected to wind down the latter part of 2023. That's the deadline to complete chemical weapons destruction. I'm Stu Johnson for Eastern Standard.
So you might have been asking yourself, and somebody needs to ask it, what if there's a leak? What do we do? John Bobel is Public Information Officer for Lexington-Fayette Emergency Management. John's here to give us some answers to that question and to some others. Thanks for stopping by Eastern Standard, John.
Thanks, Tom. It's good to be here.
And so, John, nobody likes to think about that what-if question, but history and experience tell us that anything can happen. As one who trains constantly in the field of emergency management, what are the odds that a leak out into the open air could occur?
Well, the odds are very, very, very small. I mean, every time that a chemical munition is destroyed at the Bluegrass Army Depot, the threat is reduced. The folks down there at the depot have already gotten rid of all of the blister or mustard agent. The campaign just finished with the VX agent. So now what we're left with is the GB or sarin agent that they're preparing to start the destruction process on. And it should be completely finished by the end of 2023.
Those are reassuring words, and I'm sure that that's what we hear from the Bluegrass Army Depot. But as I mentioned in the beginning, anything can happen. So what would be the worst case scenario?
Well, there are all sorts of scenarios that the Army and Madison County and all the folks in the Chemical Stockpile Emergency Preparedness Program go through and plan for. I think that any sort of accident or incident that involves an agent like sarin, the folks at the depot are prepared for that type of event, be it a small or a medium release, and they train every single day to be prepared for that type of incident regardless of how big or how small it is. We train regularly with exercises. We train regularly with all the partners who are there, and we prepare the residents of the area with extensive campaigns that are done throughout all of the communities so that they are aware of the risks, aware of the dangers, and certainly aware of the things that they can do to be better prepared for a potential incident or accident at the depot.
Are there safeguards in place to all but ensure that if there is a leak, it doesn't make it out into the open air?
That's a process question that really, as a public information officer in Fayette County, I'm not qualified to speak to. I can tell you that this will be the last site that the Army's performed a neutralization or destruction process. There have not been any incidents or accidents involving chemical agents at any of the plants throughout the United States. And given the training, the exercising, and the care that is being taken for this type of process, the chances are very, very, very small.
Right. And I don't mean to be alarmist about this. I think it's just important to know what the scenarios could be. And so that brings me to the question, if there were a leak out into the open air, if that were to occur, would the impact be determined mostly by wind direction in terms of whether it goes into a populated area or a rural area, that kind of thing?
It would be wind. It would be really the weather conditions in general. And it would certainly be the amount of agent that was spilled or made it to the atmosphere. I mean, all of those things are part of the planning process at the depot and certainly part of the exercise process that we go through on a quarterly basis. Every year we have a large-scale exercise that deals with the release of an agent. Now that the only agent that's at the depot is sarin, the exercise in September, the full-scale exercise that we'll have in September, specifically deals with the sarin agent and an accident involving that, and all the people at the depot, all the people in Madison County and the surrounding counties are well-trained and well-equipped to deal with the release and the possible relocation of residents to Fayette County, certainly.
Are there evacuation plans in place?
Well, one of the action plans, if you will, for an event at the depot is to evacuate a particular area. That's based on the computer modeling that's done on the amount of agent, the wind direction, and all of these other factors to see where the threat area is. Once that threat area has been determined, and this takes minutes, it is something that's practiced daily in terms of being able to model what happens and who is at risk if there is an accident. Once that model is done and the recommendations are made, some areas will be recommended for evacuation. Some of those folks will come to Fayette County or surrounding counties who are host counties. Some people will be in an area where the recommendation is shelter in place. They will be advised, and they've had shelter in place instructions for many, many years now. So they know to go inside, turn off their heating and ventilation systems, and seal, close windows and doors, bring everybody into an interior room, and then tune to radio or TV and wait for further instructions.
What sorts of preparations have you all made in Fayette County Emergency Management?
Well, with Fayette County, we've had several exercises already this year with regard to sheltering with our Red Cross partners, with evacuating certain populations from Madison County. We regularly work with the fire department, and they have an extensive decontamination unit, a hazmat unit, that will deal with anyone who may be contaminated with agent here. That's one of the things we'll be exercising in September is a full-scale decontamination exercise where it'll be set up at Jacobson Park. The fire department, the Red Cross, other agencies will be there to go through the full decontamination process. And that will be evaluated by local, state, and federal partners so that in case there is a real event at the depot, we'll be ready. We've been training for the potential of this for more than a decade. The federal government's been very generous in providing the partners with equipment and facilities to take care of and protect the first responders in case there is an event. So we're well trained, we are well prepared, and very capable of responding to any sort of incident or accident.
If there is such an event, how will the public be alerted?
There are many systems that will be used. Certainly in Madison County, they have an extensive siren system. In some other counties, weather radios will be sounded. Alerts will go off on your cell phones. There will be alerts that go through the standard radio and television stations. We'll put it on social media. We'll use just about every channel at our means to notify people that there is an event at the depot, the extent of the event, and what they should do to stay safe.
All right, that's John Bobel, Public Information Officer for Lexington Fayette Emergency Management. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Tom.
Nathan Vanderford is on a mission to turn around a long-standing Eastern Kentucky health crisis, cancer. The region has some of the highest rates in the whole country. Previously, Nathan, director of the Action Program at UK's Markey Cancer Center, has produced podcasts featuring oncology students sharing their personal experiences with cancer in their Eastern Kentucky hometowns. Now, he is releasing a multimedia project that highlights the burden of cancer in Appalachian Kentucky through personal narratives. And Dr. Vanderford is here with us for details. Welcome back to Eastern Standard, Nathan.
Thank you, Tom. It's always great to be with you.
And first, if you would, just remind us of the extent of cancer in Eastern Kentucky.
Yeah, it's just a devastating problem. So Kentucky ranks first in the nation in overall cancer incidence and mortality rates. So no other state in the U.S. has any bigger cancer burden than does Kentucky. And then what's worse is that the burden is greatest in Eastern Kentucky, and specifically the 54 counties that make up the Appalachian component of Eastern Kentucky. And cancer rates are significantly greater there than they are in the nation and throughout the rest of Kentucky. So just a really significant cancer burden there.
So in the introduction, I mentioned the efforts you've been making to communicate to people and to encourage oncology students to return to the region and do their professions there. But if you would, tell us about this latest project.
Absolutely. So, you know, the burden that I just mentioned, so some of the statistics I sort of rattled off, those are numbing, right? I mean, it's a major problem. But what those numbers don't really uncover are the personal stories behind each of those numbers. And so when I have students tell stories and tell, you know, their experiences with cancer, and in this new project where we've highlighted individuals and families' experiences with cancer, the goal is to really tell the personal stories behind the numbers. Cancer, as you know, Tom, it just devastates an individual when an individual gets diagnosed, and that's horrible. And then it also significantly impacts family and family dynamics, and it can impact whole communities. And so that's really what this project tries to get to, you know, how it really impacts the people and the people behind all those numbers.
Are you getting results? Are you seeing interest among young people from the region in pursuing futures, treating and preventing cancer back home?
Absolutely. So in this program that I direct, the Action Program, you know, we do a number of activities to really motivate and prepare students to pursue cancer careers. You know, we get them into research labs and things. But what I think really motivates them is doing projects like this. So the essays I have had them write, we've done a photo exhibit, photo voice project, as you know, and that's been exhibited in different locations. And then in this story, you know, we had students nominate individuals in their communities that would be good to profile. And so getting the students really involved in how cancer has impacted them and their families, that, I think, is what really motivates them. I mean, many of them get aggravated and mad about this problem, and they want to do something that can help address the problem. And so becoming cancer doctors or researchers or people who can interact with the community and help navigate people's cancer diagnosis or treatment, you know, they want to do that so they can have an impact.
You've created a website for this latest project. How can we find that online?
Yes, the title of the project is Appalachia's Burden. So if you do just www.appalachiasburden.com, you'll find it. You can also just Google, I think, Appalachia's Burden, and you can find it. It's a website project, and it's already got a lot of attention, and I think it really helps really showcase the problem that we, our communities, and our fellow Kentuckians face with this disease.
All right, that's Dr. Nathan Vandifer, Director of the Action Program at UK's Markey Cancer Center. Thank you, Nathan.
Thank you, Tom. Always a pleasure.
Coming up after the break, what is neurogastronomy?
It's basically the study of taste, but you have to differentiate between flavor and taste.
And selling bottled water in 1982.
Many people laughed at us. Buy water? I could turn this tap on, you know? I'm not going to spend money on water.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
WEKU is supported by Hicks and Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Mitch Whitaker provide legal representation for car and truck accidents and other personal injury matters. More information at 859-777-7000.
WEKU is supported by Kentucky's Touchtone Energy Cooperatives, who believe that strong communities share strong values. That's why co-ops are proud to support Special Olympics Kentucky for the past 10 years. That's the power of human connections.
Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
You've heard it said that you are what you eat, and now a new field of science is looking into why. It's called neurogastronomy.
It's basically the study of taste, but you have to differentiate between flavor and taste.
Bob Perry, chef in residence at the University of Kentucky and co-founder of the relatively new International Society of Neurogastronomy based at UK.
Flavor is purely objective. You can measure flavors in foods, the different chemicals and aromatics that provide what you smell. Taste is created in the brain, so taste is completely subjective. You and I could eat the same thing. You love it, I hate it. Flavor-wise, it's exactly the same. The difference is in our minds.
I talked with Bob Perry during interviews with many of the presenters at the recent Altec One conference in Lexington. This topic of neurogastronomy kept coming up. Basically, it involves research and practice in the areas of neuroscience, sensory perception, psychology, agriculture, culinary innovation, and clinical conditions affected by what we eat. I think it's fascinating, and I thought you might be curious, too. We are, after all, talking about the ways our brains perceive food.
The concepts and mechanisms and foundations were there for decades, if not centuries, actually.
Dr. Dan Hahn, chief of the Division of Neuropsychology at the UK College of Medicine. He's another co-founder, as well as a past president of the International Society of Neurogastronomy.
The movement to translate what we know in the context of neurosciences and individual perception and psychology and how that shapes an individual desire for food consumption and what that means for macro level agricultural technology and consumerism and so on. As a movement, it hasn't been conceptualized until relatively recently, about 2015 or so. Dr. Gordon Shepherd at Yale coined the term and published it in Nature years back. And the challenge was set for the scientists and clinicians and other academics by Dr. Gordon Shepherd to come out of the silos and actually talk to each other and educate each other and have a larger optic to look at some tangible questions that are needing to be asked and answered relatively quickly because we have 9 to 10 billion people to feed by 2050.
So how does this work, Dr. Hahn?
Industry has done a marvelous job, actually, looking at what creates the perfect crisp for a potato chip or what lighting or what decibel makes the perfect ambiance for umami flavors for a steak dinner with red wine and so on. But what we're trying to do is to identify all those variables and come up with ways to I don't want to say manipulate them, but actually modulate them and use them so that we're not just merely using them for consumerism, but to expand that concept to modulate the brain to want to eat and then desire flavors that come from smaller carbon footprint ingredients and create that demand for the masses so that we could actually have an efficient way of delivering food and nutrients for, again, 10 billion people.
The matter of the Cadbury Dairy Milk Chocolate Bar gives us a good example. Psychologist and cognitive neuroscientist Rachel Herz, a leading world expert on the psychological science of smell, cites the example in the introduction of her book on the subject, The Scent of Desire, Discovering Our Enigmatic Sense of Smell.
I'm not exactly sure what the current Cadbury chocolate bar looks like in the UK. This was several years ago, but they had changed from their original iconic squares to more rounded squares. So they were sort of thicker and more rounded and curvy. And all kinds of loyal Cadbury bar consumers were calling into the company, complaining that it was sickly sweet, that it was disgustingly sweet now that the shape had changed. And they were convinced that actually it was loaded with extra sugar and this was highly unpleasant, when in fact the ingredients Cadbury insisted had remained identical and all they had done was sort of modify the shape slightly. And what this shows is how the shapes of what we are looking at and all kinds of things when we really do eat with our eyes first in lots of ways, and what we see really has an influence on our perception of taste, and rounded shapes actually make us perceive things to be sweeter. So you want to serve dessert on round plates, because on square plates, they actually are perceived as somewhat less sweet.
Lexington restaurateur and chef Wita Michael, another charter member of the International Society of Neurogastronomy.
One of the funny things that Dr. Hahn and I have done together when we've talked about this to large groups is we serve dessert, and I make a beet cake. So it's pink, and we pretend that it has icing on it, and so it looks like a little pink strawberry pétifort, but it's actually, there's no sugar whatsoever. It's all beets and like cream cheese. And the brain thinks it's going to get this, you know, cotton candy cake, and instead it gets a big, ooh, no sugar. And then the other cake is dark green, like almost black, and it's made with matcha tea, and it's very, very sweet. But because of its color, it doesn't taste sweet. In fact, it has 4 or 5 more times sugar than a regular cake recipe, but does not taste sweet in the brain.
Oh,
so it's a really fascinating thing to experience and to watch.
That really is.
And then, of course, people get mad at me because it's a terrible dessert.
Michael came to neurogastronomy after her mother was diagnosed with cancer, and she volunteered to cook for Hope Lodge, an American Cancer Society facility in Lexington.
The idea is that chemotherapy and other strong medications can make foods that you really loved in the past, like for my mom, it would have been kale greens, and make them so bitter that, you know, she couldn't handle them. It can also impact your sense of smell, and it can challenge your olfactory receptors. And so getting that physiology to clinical practice in ways that help the clinician and the patient is sort of the role of the chef.
There's so many factors that go into making a plate of food.
UK chef in residence, Bob Perry.
First is visual. You're always going to look at the food visually first. Then you've got the smells. Then you've got texture to consider. Then you've got the interplay of the different flavors to consider. What are you going to drink with that also, whether it's a wine or any other beverage? And there's a really interesting gentleman at Oxford, Charles Spence, at the Crossmodal Lab at Oxford, and he has done hundreds of experiments playing around with food and eating. For instance, he found that dessert tastes sweeter on a blue plate than it does on a white plate, and coffee tastes less bitter in a black cup than it does in a white cup. And he's played with some interesting, as that's the reason for the name of his lab, Crossmodal. So he served people seafood dishes with and without sounds of the sea in their headphones to see whether they liked it more or less. So it's really fascinating field, and that's a large part of neurogastronomy too.
Let's hear more about this plate thing.
So an ideal plate is round and red and small.
Rachel Herz.
Round plates, first of all, tend to go with a lot of the foods we eat in a couple of different ways. One thing, roundness can also make us perceive something as possibly being sweeter. So for desserts, it's particularly good. The other thing with round plates is that for things like a pasta, you know, when you put something on a round plate, because that can clump in a way that's sort of also spherical. It looks like, for instance, if you had a small plate and you took a serving of pasta, you could fill that small plate very quickly. And that could look like a lot of food. And that appearance of a lot of food is actually in and of itself more satiating. Whereas if you had a much larger plate, that same scoop of food would be sitting in the middle of it and you'd have all this empty plate around it and think that, oh, I really haven't gotten very much here. And even though you've eaten the exact same amount as on the small plate, you don't feel nearly as satiated and happy and satisfied with it. So we're more likely to eat more and serve ourselves more. And the red aspect of it comes from the fact that there's some evidence that suggests that red in nature is kind of a danger warning, get my attention cue. I mean, and we are much more likely to sort of pay attention to what we're eating when the vessel we're eating from is red. And so we are actually aware of the fact, oh, you know, I just finished this. Do I actually need to go back for more? So again, it's about awareness. And when our attention is drawn to what we're eating, we get more pleasure from it because we're actually savoring the flavor. We're in the moment, sort of the idea of mindfulness, and we can figure out whether or not we want more or not.
Think of this next time you're eating out. Weta Michael.
You know, you can use things like the color of the plate that you're eating. Some colors make us think, oh, this is going to be sweet. Some colors make us think, oh, this is going to be bitter. So we can change the color. We can change the texture of the silverware that we're doing. We can use all of our senses to help reprogram our brains around which foods taste sweet and which foods don't taste sweet.
Flavor perception is a truly multi-dimensional experience.
Dr. Dan Hahn, the neuropsychology chief at UK.
It's just something that we don't think about because it's one of the most complicated sensory processing mechanisms that we know of. Because, you know, the evolutionary process has dictated that, you know, you don't have to waste too much calories in your thinking process to how all this works every time you eat. You know, otherwise we'll be burning off the calories they will be consuming, right? So it's incredibly complicated, but seldom do we actually pause and think about the mechanism. Smell and taste constitute flavor, but the entire experience also draws from sight and other senses like texture, sound, and they all connect to your long-term stored memory and reward circuits of the brain and so on. And there's aspects of anticipation before you actually bite into your first piece of steak and so on.
Again, the question, how does this work?
Let me give you the macro version first.
Okay.
So there's a phenomenon called a synesthetic experience, and we all have it. If I show you a picture of red jagged edges, you're more likely to call that kiki than mubu. And again, the word kiki and mubu are just made up words. Okay, they hold no intrinsic meaning behind them. But your brain is already wired, and this is cross-cultural. We could do this in Asia. We could do this in Africa. We could do this in Europe. We could do this anywhere. Your brain's already wired to draw from the references that's already networked in and from genetic memory, even before you had your own frame of references, just what the species have actually packed into our evolution. So when you're thinking something jagged, we're thinking, we're drawing from the library in the brain that is associated with something a little more sharp as a consonant and so on, and then with something more like a cloud-like, fluffy visual, your brain is drawing from more smooth-sounding vowels and so on. So imagine for a moment how complicated that network is, and we just take it for granted, and we don't think about it. Now, that same principle applies to other senses. So sound, decibel, depending on what kind of sound it is and so on, that's going to actually draw from the referential library in your brain and affect sense of other senses, including smell and taste.
You know, in some parts of the world, people think nothing of eating insects, while in other places, such as here in the USA, we're not crazy about that idea. But can the human brain be tricked? Again, Dr. Dan Hahn.
You can go to other parts of the world, and eating bugs is not thought of as an alternative source of fuel that you just kind of make do. Rather, it's something that is actually sought out. Now, I'll actually pose this as a question to derive at the answer. So, I love cheese. I'm a sucker for cheese. Give me Gouda, you know, some brie, you know, what have you, you know. It's, you know, I'm a sucker for all sorts of cheese. My wife is not. Okay. Now, if you take the umami and, I mean, the savory, salty, addictive flavor out of the referential library that I talked about from your brain, if you just purely logically think about what cheese really is, it's pretty gross, actually, if you think about it. Nobody thinks about it in Western culture, as an example, because it's something that we've been saturated with. I mean, you don't think about the process. You don't think about the mechanism. You don't question it. You taste it and then realize, oh, you know, I like the savory experience, you know, and then you get to a point where you crave for it, right? So let me actually provide reason behind that before we even unpack this. If we could get an entire culture for hundreds of years, if not thousands, to not ask the question about the entire process of making cheese, which is taking lactation from a different species and making sure it rots. And then later, trying to see if you could salvage it by eating it. If you could have an entire part of the species not questioning that and actually craving that process, you could do the exact same for bugs.
You know, you almost want to ask, what is wrong with us anyway? Right? So it seems we're going to be hearing more and more about this new science of neurogastronomy.
You know who's used it the most? Folks that are into packaging processed foods.
Chef and restaurateur, Weta Michael.
So potato chips sound a certain way. And when they sound like those bags, when they crinkle and crackle, that makes you feel like it's crunchy and it sets a craving up for that crunchy, salty flavor. So those folks know what they're doing. And now we need to take that bench science and really work on it for our nutritional health. And I think we're at the cusp of really great things to come.
For Dr. Hahn, the ultimate mission focuses on the world population growth that he mentioned earlier, and in the face of the impacts on agriculture of changing climate.
We have to re-ask the question before we identify the problem. What is the problem? Well, is it truly that we have too many people and growth in the species and not enough food for them? Data actually suggests otherwise. Hmm. It's the imbalance of what we desire and what is available for producing crops and so on. So the question has to be reframed to ask, well, how do we actually regain the balance? And I think by coming out of everybody's silos and crossing the aisles, so to say, and then learning from each other and getting better optics and a bird's eye view of what we didn't know could really help all these different fields of sciences come together and come up with an innovative solution, which is what neurogastronomists are doing.
So we are what we eat. In fact, the future turns on what we eat. After hearing about this new science of neurogastronomy, the phrase gives us a lot to think about. Our thanks to Alltech for the interviews. Full disclosure, Neil Kesterson and I worked under contract to gather them at the recent Alltech One conference in Lexington.
My baby,
It's been 40 years since the Griffin family discovered a flowing underground spring in the old abandoned limestone quarry they had purchased next to High Bridge on the Kentucky River. Today, High Bridge Springwater, still owned by Linda Griffin and her four sisters, is one of the oldest women-owned businesses in Kentucky, bottling and selling the equivalent of over 8 Olympic swimming pools of water a year. Linda Griffin, the company's president and CEO, is with us to talk about that history. Welcome, Linda.
Thank you.
So how was that spring found in the first place?
That spring was found by the rock quarry, Kentucky Stone Company, when they were mining the limestone. They blasted into an underground aquifer. And all of a sudden, the water started pouring from the ceiling. And their solution to that was to blast a drainage ditch where the water flowed outside for, 20 years maybe.
So basically what you've done is taken what had been a nuisance and turned it into a gold mine.
Yes, it solved a problem. Actually, when my father first bought that property, his idea was to put a storage company in, which he did incorporate, a company called Kentucky Underground Storage. One of the problems with that facility, that idea, was the humidity. So he hired an engineer from Kansas City, Kansas, where there are many underground facilities. And the engineer, one of his first comments to him was, well, Mr. Griffin, you know you're going to have to control the water in the back of the quarry. So, you know, time went on, and my sister and I were working with him, helping just clean up the quarry. And he said to us one day, girls, why don't we bottle that water? And this was 1982. There was not a bottle of drinking water in a grocery store in our market. There was distilled water with the ironing supplies, what you put in your steamer.
But we didn't drink that.
Well, you didn't drink that.
And as I understand it, there was a flow rate in that spring of about, so no wonder the humidity, about 60,000 gallons a day?
Yes.
A day?
Yes. It varies some, but yes.
Well, as you say, at first you all did everything, the bottling, the sales, the delivery. You started out on a forklift yourself.
Yes.
Do you recall what went through your mind the day that you were told that it was going to be all hands on deck or underground, in the case may be, and everybody had to pitch in?
You know, it evolved. When we realized that he was serious about the idea of bottling water, we just started. He bought some equipment, and the people we bought the equipment from said, well, here's where you get your gallon bottles. So we got the gallon bottles, and we really didn't think about it. We just started doing it.
Well, as you said, this was the early 80s, and bottled water was not a thing back then. And I just wondered, did it feel kind of iffy at that time, or was it a tough sell back then?
Oh, very iffy. Many people laughed at us. Buy water? I can turn this tap on, you know? Uh-huh. I'm not going to spend money on water. So it was a very iffy idea at the time.
And how do you, so there's a big difference between the spring water that you all bottle and what comes out of the tap. We can tell it just by tasting it. But what are the properties of the water that you bottle and market compared to processed water?
The spring water that we use goes through a process that's called reverse osmosis. And that takes out everything but a trace of minerals. So the quality from the beginning, from the aquifer, has a very low total dissolved solids count in it. And then by the time it goes through the reverse osmosis, you end up with pretty much pure water. Nothing added to it. You know, city water has to go through a process coming from the river or, you know, wherever it's coming from. But ours is good right from the start.
Now, some of those early customers are still your customers today. Is that right?
Yes.
They took a leap of faith. What do you recall from those times when they finally signed on?
My father would send my younger sister and I out in a pickup truck full of cases of gallon drinking water and say to us, don't come back until you sell all that water. So we would go to Lexington And at the time, there were Kroger's, there were Randall's, there was County Market. There was a variety of stores. And we would actually, this is hard to believe today, we would actually go to the backroom door, knock on the door, and somebody would finally open the door, and they'd look at us, two girls, and they'd go, "What?" And we were like, "You want to buy some water?"
But that was
and that's what they did.
Uh-huh.
They laughed incredulously.
But it caught on with the couples, didn't it?
But it caught on. And the other thing about that time was when they did say yes, they would say, "Well, when can we get it?" And we said, "Oh, right now. We have it in the truck." And at the time, you didn't have all the computer checkout. So you really could go to the shelf, spread some product out, put your gallon bottles on, take a price gun, price it, and then they could start selling that day.
And was the truck empty when you went home?
Always, because of Mr. Fitch in Wilmore, Kentucky. Fitch's IGA. We would stop and go, "Mr. Fitch, we have three cases left." He'd go, "Bring it in, girls."
And would it sell?
It would sell.
People caught on.
Yes.
Well, let's fast forward to present times and this pandemic we've been dealing with. What happened to you all during the pandemic?
That was kind of brutal. At the very beginning, we were selling water like crazy. Our wholesale grocery customers were buying lots of products. And then mid-March, it just stopped overnight. You know, I guess when everything just finally shut down, mm-hmm. A lot of our commercial, well, most of our commercial accounts closed. I mean, it just came to a screeching halt. It was a pretty scary time. You know, we had to lay off 9 people, unfortunately, but we brought them back after a period of time. But it was tough.
Yeah. Well, do you feel you've recovered at this point?
We have recovered. We have recovered this year. The numbers are looking like they did in 2019.
Mm-hmm. Hybrid Springs is often called on to provide drinking water after natural disasters, tornadoes, floods. Is there one of those events that really sticks in your memory?
Probably two, Hurricane Andrew and Hugo. In those years, the water and bottled water industry was more regional. So when those tornadoes or hurricanes hit, those companies in that area were out of business. And I remember a customer of ours from Paris had a relative that lived in Santee, South Carolina. This was after Hugo. And she called us and said, "Listen, they have nothing." And we were like, "Oh, okay, well," we decided to donate a truckload of water. A company in Nicholasville provided the driver and the semi. And we called FEMA, and they said, "Well, Santee hasn't called in to report." And we were like, "Well, they're wiped out." You know, they really can't. So we sent the driver on. But you really do, as a side note, have to be careful going into these areas after disasters like that, because mm-hmm. people do some pretty bad things trying to sell products. But we went to Santee, and they were in tents. We were the first outside help they had seen. I mean, it was a small little community in the middle of South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And my sister actually was coming to a beach vacation years later, like 15 years later, she and her husband, and they had a problem with their flat tire or something. And it was in Santee, South Carolina.
Mm.
And I'll be darned, the guy that came out to help them said, "Hi, Bridge. You guys don't know that how much you saved our lives back
wow.
in, you know, 15 years ago."
Isn't that something?
That was something.
Well, how do you guys compete with the behemoths out there, the Coke and Pepsis of the world?
I don't.
That's a good answer. So not on your radar, huh?
No, when we call on accounts and they say, "Well, I can get that cheaper from Coke," we go, "Well, fine. That's your choice, obviously."
Mm-hmm.
So we don't try to compete in that market. That's not our market. It's not what we do. So I just don't.
You mentioned a moment ago that you're recovering and you've hired back people. Are you looking for more?
Oh, yes.
Because I know everybody
just like
is.
Everybody this, is. Yep. I was just talking to our general manager today. We're going to put magnetic signs on the trucks that say hiring. We need people in the plant. We need route drivers. We could use somebody in the office. It's tough.
So give you a call?
Give us a call.
What's that number?
859-858-4407.
All right. Maybe your phone will ring.
Okay.
I know, Linda, that for a long time you have been a staunch supporter of some really key cultural treasures here in the area, mostly having to do with live music, as far as I know. And I just wonder what drives that. I get the sense that it's not just about marketing.
No, no, it isn't. Although Troubadour and the chamber music are our two mainstays.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Michael Jonathan does a great job marketing. But it is more than that, and it kind of goes back to your question about Coke and Pepsi. You know, I tell people one of the reasons we can support the Troubadour is because we aren't Coke or Pepsi. Our pricing isn't that cheap. But that extra money goes to community organizations or music festivals like Troubadour, because we live here too. You know, it's our community, mm-hmm. and you just want to share. If you're doing well, we have no problem with sharing the wealth.
Well, what have I not touched on, or what have I not asked you that as you were heading over here, you were thinking, I hope he asked me that.
Wow. Well, one thing is we had another company that's 40 years old this year also, which is the original storage company, Kentucky Underground Storage.
Uh-huh.
You know, we store 450,000 boxes of records. We have online backup. We do scanning of documents. UK is a big account for that. So it's interesting that you have two companies in the same underground quarry that are so diverse. And it would take someone like my dad, who had an entrepreneurial mind, I think, to have developed those two or have even thought about it.
To accommodate those two side by side, did you have to think about that moisture issue?
Yes. That's what brought the moisture issue to the forefront, uh-huh. is when we were talking about storing the corrugated boxes of records. You know, you had to have the humidity under control.
How'd you solve it?
Well, one thing, we started bottling the water, but then the other big thing was we bought a huge dehumidifier,
uh-huh.
that we operate to this day.
Interesting. Linda Griffin, President, CEO of Hybrid Springwater. Thank you so much for sharing your story, Linda.
You're welcome.
That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor, Spencer Shook, intern, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. You can find us online at weku.org or esweku.org and on the WEKU app, NPR One, and the Google News app. Would you like to suggest a topic? Drop us a line at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.